About a month ago, let me back up a moment. Isaiah struggles with his teeth. For some odd reason, Isaiah, our oldest son, has just teeth issues. And I don't like dentists, but we had to take Isaiah to the dentist, and I went with him. And the dentist tells Heather, you know, part of Isaiah's problem with his teeth could be that you all are sharing germs, and that maybe some of the folks in your house don't have good teeth, and then you're swapping germs in whatever form or fashion, things aren't clean well, you're sharing cups, whatever it might be, and that his teeth might not be able to get clean because various other folks in your house have teeth that need clean too. So, of course, all the eyes came upon me, right? Partly because my dental hygiene probably could be taken up a notch. It's not that I don't brush. I do brush. But likewise, like Isaiah, my teeth just need help. I had a tooth that actually broke probably about 3 years ago, a molar up here on this side. And so I agreed, because I love my son, not because I like dentists, but because I love my son, I agreed to let the dentist look at my teeth. So I went to the dentist about a month and a half ago, and it was the first time that a dental hygienist had looked at my mouth in probably about a decade. And you can see the grimaces. Some of you are going, oh, that is so disgusting. And some of you are going, man, that's what I would do if I could. But you almost have to strap me into the chair in some ways. But the dentist looked at my teeth and said, you have two teeth that need extracted. Oh, man. So we went back about 2 weeks later, and sure enough, I had a molar on this side and a molar on this side, the one that was cracked, that had to be extracted. Extracted them on a Monday morning, and the Novocaine was wonderful. It did its job. I had sutures up here. The drive home, the Novocaine started to wear off, and I had pain like I have never experienced before in my life that Monday afternoon. Some of you know what I'm talking about. And it was just that, like, driving you nuts, like you feel like your head's going to pop off type of pain that's going on. And for the first time in quite some time, I sent Heather to the store to actually fulfill a prescription for me. And that stuff was wonderful. But that there's another problem that comes along with getting your teeth extracted, is that you're not allowed to eat anything hard. How many of you have had teeth extracted or have had wisdom teeth out, and you know that you're not allowed to eat anything that could injure the wound of where your tooth used to be, right? And partly because the tooth is still supposed to be there, but that for whatever reason it comes out, and now you're not allowed to do anything, eat anything fun there. Not anything chewy that can get stucky up in there. It needs to be soft, mushy stuff. Now, I want to complicate this issue. I get my tooth pulled on Monday. Thursday, I have to go up to Asbury University to spend a couple days with Wyatt Gantz. And so I'm up there with Wyatt. Wyatt was in a program developing leaders, teen leaders, and he asked me to come up and help him with his project. So I go up for 2 days. Now, I'm on a university campus cafeteria, and the first meal I go to, and I'm like, oh, boy, what am I going to eat? And so the first meal that they had was ribs. And I'm like, oh, I could eat some ribs. Because at home, you want to know what I've been eating? Applesauce and yogurt, right? Applesauce and yogurt. And applesauce and yogurt. And applesauce and yogurt. And then I go, and ribs. And I can't eat that. It's not going to be good for my wound. No, I have sutures in my mouth. I can't do that. So I start walking around the cafeteria. What can I eat? The only thing in the cafeteria I could eat was hummus. So I grabbed a plate, and I took a spoon and just threw the hummus on the plate. And I'm like, all right, this is going to be awkward. But I go back to the table with all of the folks from all over the Eastern Seaboard that have gathered at Asbury University. And there I am eating spoonfuls of hummus while people are chowing down on ribs. Actually, the next evening was worse because they had tacos. And there's just something about tacos. But there I am stuck with my hummus. There was a moment Friday evening where I think I started to grab hold of what the Israelites were dealing with in some form or fashion. I wanted to eat tacos Friday night because tacos are yummy. And I can salivate when I think about tacos. But I'm stuck with hummus. And I like hummus. Hummus is delicious. But when I can have tacos and all I can eat is hummus, that is upsetting. And so there's this desire and this longing for tacos that I want. And just like I think that these folks, their longing and their hunger is that they want some meat to eat. They want to not have to think about where they're going to get food. And they long for it. And I really struggle because this passage, they're not even out of the wilderness a month and a half. And they've already forgotten what it's like to be in slavery. They're dreaming about what it was like to be back in Egypt again. They just got delivered from something that was horrendous and that they've been complaining about being in for 400 years. They've been enslaved. And here they are, not even 6 weeks afterwards, and all they can think about is, oh, I wish we were in slavery again. At least we knew where our food was coming from. And I go, wow, I wonder how much I do things like that, where the grass is always greener on the other side, right? I just want to get over here. I just want to do this thing, because if I do this, it's going to be better than the mess that I'm in right now. And then I get over there, and I go, oh, you know, I wish I could go back, because this mess isn't as fun as that mess. You see, this is the Israelites' dilemma throughout the next few chapters of Exodus. Quite honestly, it becomes the dilemma of the Israelites throughout their history, is that they're stuck trying to figure out, what does it actually mean to be free to live for God? Take a note at this, is that God, and I've mentioned this to you before, that it's unfortunate that oftentimes the storybook Bibles and the movies that we see tend to stop the story of Exodus at the crossing of the Red Sea. That we go through this amazing deliverance of God, that he initiates and he pulls these people out of slavery, and that we have all of these wonderful dramas and we picture Charlton Heston sloshing and making bricks in the mud, or we think of the DreamWorks film Prince of Egypt, and we see Moses figuring out what it means to live in Midian, and that we get there and we stop at Exodus 15, and that we don't keep pushing through the rest of Exodus, because Exodus is 40 chapters long, and the climax of the text is actually not the crossing of the Red Sea in Exodus 14. The climax of the text of Exodus is actually in chapter 40, where the glory of God descends upon the tabernacle, and that the God of the Exodus is now the God who dwells with his people. It's why we've named this sermon series that we are delivered from slavery to dwell. Delivered to dwell. We are delivered out of slavery to dwell with this God. Do you follow me? And so that this is the beginning of this. This is the beginning of developing this people. Once they have been delivered, preparing this people to actually dwell with this God. To dwell with this unique, powerful creator. This unique, powerful being that by his mighty hand and outstretched arm decided to take this people who were weak and were enslaved and said, I pick you, you're getting out of here. And now you need to start to live as a people whom I will dwell with. This is the narrative of Israel's history from this point on. God developing a people with which he can dwell. Now it's interesting, because I believe this statement, and you've heard me say it before, and it's not original to me, but that it was easy for God to get Israel out of Egypt. That was the easy part. It's really hard to get Egypt out of Israel. Let me say that again and let it sink. It's really easy for God. It was an easy work. He didn't break a sweat doing this, to get Israel out of Egypt. But it is an incredibly difficult work to get Egypt out of Israel. What do I mean by that? When Israel was slaves to Pharaoh, and even prior to that with Joseph, that we see that the mindset of Pharaoh was one of limited resources. We take a look at the narrative of Joseph and late in Genesis as we see that he collects resources for Pharaoh. And that the whole nation of Israel, the whole nation of Egypt becomes Pharaoh's personal property. And that we continue in Exodus 1 and that the Israelites have become slaves. And what are they doing? They are building storehouses. They're building buildings so that Pharaoh can hoard food and wealth inside of it. That's what Israel was doing. They have names in it. These are the only two from archaeological records, but then ones that were given in Exodus 1 is Ramesses and Pithom. Storehouses where grain and wealth would be stored so that Pharaoh could be secure and safe and that he didn't have to worry of any type of lack of anything. The reasoning behind that, I think, comes down to this, is that there are some ways that we think that there's a limit on the resources available to us. There's only so much money, there's only so much food, there's only so much spotlight time, there's only so many positions available, that everything that we experience is a limitation of resources. And so that the way that we figure, if I can, because of this limited resources, if I don't get mine, someone else is going to get it. The way that we talk about this in our world is we say, you got to look out for number one. Or it's a dog-eat-dog world. And that what we're really communicating is, you better look out for yourself, because if you don't, no one else will. No one's looking out for you but you. And that's the world that Pharaoh and us live in. And that we're told, you best make yourself. You best get your own house in order, because there's no one looking out for you. And that this is the world that Pharaoh is in. And that the problem is that the Israelites can't seem to break themselves out of that thought process, even though they have been liberated from Pharaoh. And the reason why is what they do with the bread. What they do with the bread, that their thought processes about limited resources have been shaped by the thought processes of Pharaoh. And the thought processes of Pharaoh said, there's only a limited amount. I better get all of it I possibly can. And that Israel is stuck in this type of thought process. Take a look at the text. In verse 9. I'm in the wrong spot. In verse 13. Keep going. There we go. Here we go. Verse 17, and the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. And in verse 19, let no one leave any of it over till the morning. They're not supposed to store it. They're not supposed to store it. Don't leave any of it left until the morning. But what do? They did not listen to Moses in verse 20. And some of them left. And what did it do? It bred worms and it stank. Some people might want to eat those worms. I don't know. Extra source of protein. But that the fact is that their thinking about provision has been shaped in this world that says there's only a limited amount of this bread stuff that God's going to give us. We can't really trust that there's going to be more tomorrow, even though God said he's going to rain it down every day. We can't trust that there's going to be more tomorrow, so I better make sure that I get some. And what's really cool is if I store it and I keep enough of it, when God eventually shuts it off, then I can even make money off of it. Because I have a surplus, and because I have a surplus, people will come to me and say, I need something to eat. And then I can go, oh, give me your goat. I'll give you some for your goat. Or, ooh, you have some gold earrings. I'll give you a quart jar if you give me your gold earrings. You see what this happens. I'm talking about economies, right? Is that out of the surplus of an economy, we make money. And that this is the way that this thing rolls, and that these people are dealing with these types of thought processes. And that the problem is that their desire to eat has been corrupted to the point where it is now used as a situation to manipulate other people. It's used as a situation to be able to not trust the provision of God any longer. In that, in turn, God goes, I can't live with people like that. What has been the goal of this whole thing? I want a people with which I can dwell. Exodus 40, the glory of God falling upon their tabernacle. That the purpose of this is that God would have a people with whom he can dwell, who will reflect his glory in the world. And that they are still operating in this mindset that has been shaped by the world of Pharaoh that says there's never enough. There's never enough. Excess is better. Excess is success. So here we are. We're stuck in this place where these people have been shaped by this and their desires. I need to address this again because I really believe it's at the core of what the issue of American discipleship is about. And so for those of you who've heard me say this and you're going, I wish Evan wouldn't talk about this anymore, I want to point you back. I'll point you back to a guy by the name of Martin Luther, whose congregation said, why do you preach the same thing every week? And he said to them, because you didn't get it the first time. Desires in and of themselves are not evil. You've heard me say this. God, I'm getting hungry right now. I can feel it in my stomach. That's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to be hungry. It's not a bad thing to desire water, which is what happens in the next chapter. It's not a bad thing that God has placed in us a libido that has a sex longing. That's not evil in and of itself. The problem is that those longings and those cravings can be used against us and outside of the character of God because they've been shaped by our fallen sinful nature that looks to serve ourselves first and says, if that's at the expense of someone else, so be it. And I've given you plenty of examples of what that looks like in the past, of the ways that we hoard, the ways that we use our power to manipulate situations. But that the reality is that those desires can be turned back out by the power of God. And that this narrative of the manna is meant to start doing that for the people of Israel who have been delivered out of slavery. They're no longer bound to serve themselves or to serve Pharaoh any longer. They have been set free by the power of God to now serve God wholeheartedly. With that their intention, their motivations, their desires would be turned outward. And not to serve themselves anymore, but that my hunger can be used to serve someone else. Think of this. Heather and I had the privilege of having a conversation with some missionaries from the Church of Latter-day Saints this week. Stop by the house. You guys probably have had those yourselves. And, you know, we weren't rude to them. We didn't want to shut the door on them. And they said that they've had plenty of people who do that. I strongly encourage you not to do something like that. Be the light of Jesus to them. Know your stuff, though, because they sound good. Be ready to have a conversation with them. Be ready to give a reason for the hope that you have. But it was interesting of the way that they are actually able to use their own hunger to serve others. I asked them a question about the way that the Church of Latter-day Saints handles governments and handles the issue of various service components of what they do. And you know what they do? Is that the first Sunday of every month that they take what they call a fast offering. And that the challenge is that Sunday, they're supposed to fast two meals, every person in the congregation. And the money that would be used on those two meals would be given to the church to care for those who have need. Literally, they are going hungry for a day in order that others may eat. And these are people who don't even claim the full deity of Jesus Christ. Or at least a perverted deity of Jesus Christ, I should say. but that they're using their honest hunger for food to actually go and bless somebody else. That's crazy. But that's a way that that can be turned back out. That our desire for intimacy physically, that is on such a salt in our culture. Our world is assaulted with this idea that our physical bodies cannot be mastered, but that if I have certain attractions that don't match up to traditional moral values, that it's okay because God made me this way, or whatever those reasonings are. But that the reality is that the scriptures show, and Paul even talks about it in Ephesians 5, that marriage is not just for the pleasure, the physical sexual pleasure of the two parties involved, but rather that there's a mysterious union between Jesus and his church that is exemplified in the union between a husband and a wife. And that there's something unique there that we can't put our finger on, but that there's something deeper about the mysteries of God that are revealed by the corralling and the shaping of those desires in a way that honors and glorifies God. You know where the manna narrative talks about this? Is in the way that they name it. They've never seen this stuff before. And what do? They take a look at it and they go, huh? What is this stuff? And that our longings for intimacy, our longings for physical comforts, our desires for various things are meant to turn themselves out so that people look at us and go, huh? What is this crazy God you worship? You mean you're not a slave to your appetites? It's the way that Paul says it. That we are not to be a slave to anything. But that we turn out and say, the deeper mysteries of God can be revealed because I use my cravings and my longings to bless someone else rather than to serve myself. My longings for recognition, my longings for love, my longings to give love, my longings to be seen and to be heard, the longing for my voice to have weight and value, that those are not evil in and of themselves, but when they're manipulated to gain control and to bend people to your will, that suddenly that it doesn't really look like God anymore. But rather that the dividing walls of hostility have been broken in Jesus and that all are one in him. And that it's safe to speak your mind and to know that you're still going to be loved and cherished and nurtured, to be corrected. And that's not wrong. Because the goal is to look like Jesus. Now, this all sounds great, but I need to throw one more monkey wrench into this thing. Because the Israelites fail here, right? Take a look with me. When God says in verse 4, I'm about to rain down bread on them. This really sticks out to me, and I tried to emphasize it when I read it. I'm about to rain down bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion. They're going to trust in the provision of God, and that by trusting in this provision, that the glory of God will fall. People are going to go, whoa, the mystery of God. But this is interesting. I'm doing this, why? That I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. And that the problem is with this is that they don't do it. They fail the test. They fail the test. And that the problem is that if we go throughout the Old Testament, that they're going to consistently fail the test over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. They fail the test. That the test is, will this people take their desires and turn them outward and live for me or not? And over and over and over again, they miss it. They've been shaped by thought processes that are not of God. They've been shaped by desires that are not of God. And that what they do is that they keep on failing the test. And so God proposes a solution. If you have your Bible, grab it quickly. Go to the right a couple of books. We're going to be in Deuteronomy 10. Deuteronomy is this amazing sermon that Moses preaches right before his passing, before the people walk into the promised land. And that Deuteronomy 10, he's been going through the history, and that he talks about the tablets of stone, but that he says this in Deuteronomy 10. And now, Israel, what does the Lord require of you? In verse 12. But to fear the Lord, to walk in his ways, to love him, and to serve the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, and to keep the commandments and statutes of the Lord, which I am commanding for you, for your good, for your freedom, for all that is good in you, that to be poured out upon others, that this is what you're to do, you're to obey. What has God done in Exodus 16? He has given a command for their good that they failed to keep. And what does God say in verse 16? Circumcise, therefore, the foreskin of your heart and be no longer stubborn. What's that saying is, take off all the callous goop off of your heart, all of the stuff that's holding you back from living out God's purposes, all of the stuff that's holding you back, that's keeping your desires focused in on yourself. Rip that stuff off of your being and start living the way that God has asked you to live. Now, there's an interesting thing with this. Is that who's the one to be circumcising? Take a look at the verbiage. Verse 16, circumcise. The commandment is to you. You circumcise your heart. You do it. You're the one who's supposed to rip off the callous of your heart and to start walking diligently and to fulfill the commandments of your God. Right? Amen. That's what's there. And then we see that throughout the text. You can find it in Jeremiah as well, who's been heavily influenced by the writing of Deuteronomy. That this command, you circumcise your heart. Jeremiah comes to the point in Jeremiah 4 where he says this. He's lamenting the fact that the people continually fail, even though they've been told over and over and over again, try harder, try harder, try harder, circumcise your heart, keep doing it. And Jeremiah comes to this statement. Can an Ethiopian change the color of his skin? Can a leopard take away the spots from his print? For those of you who don't know, Ethiopians are very dark. And guess what? Ethiopians can't change the color of their skin. And guess what? Leopards can't take the spots off their coat. And that he comes to the conclusion that Israel and Judah will never be able to fully commit themselves to the way of God. Folks, that's us. Apart, on our own, if we are left with the command, you circumcise your heart and follow after the ways of God, guess what's going to happen? You're going to fall on your face consistently. If all you're told is pull up your bootstraps and try harder, guess what's going to happen? You're going to fall over all over again. But that this amazing thing happens. I'm still in Deuteronomy. Go to Deuteronomy 30. The end of the sermon, for some reason, Moses decides to change his tune. And the crazy thing is Jeremiah does it too in Jeremiah 31. But that this text goes on. So Moses has preached his sermon, and he's come now to the point where he's calling for decision in Deuteronomy 30. And he says in verse 11, for this commandment that I command you today is not too hard for you, neither is it far off. And then he keeps on going. He says, you need to choose life. I've set before you life and death. We love this verse for pro-life movements, right? We have set before you the path of life and death. Therefore, choose life. But that the whole thing about this, about moving and doing the commandments that are not too hard, is set up in verse 6 of Deuteronomy 30. Take a look at it with me. I'm going to start in verse 5. The Lord your God will bring you into the land that your fathers possessed, that you may possess it, and he will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. Here we go. And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and that you may live. That suddenly Moses' tune has changed, that it's no longer you circumcise your heart, but rather it's
the Lord your God will circumcise your heart, that you will love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your soul, all of your mind, and all of your strength. Folks, if you don't let go of your heart, you'll continually fall short of all that God has planned for you. If you don't let go and say, God, the desires of my being need to be placed before you so that you can tear away the callous hard-heartedness of who I am, and that I need to lay it before you and say, Lord, you circumcise my heart. You peel it away. The way that the prophet Ezekiel says it in Ezekiel 36 is that God will take the heart of stone and replace it with a heart of flesh, and that the law of God will be written on it. That it's no longer a hard stone tablet with the law that is immovable and only can break in pieces when it attempts to be moved, but rather that it is a heart of flesh that can beat and move with the heartbeat and movements of God. Folks, God's asking you to allow him to circumcise your heart today, to allow your desires, your passions to be molded and shaped by his heart and mind for you. That's what he's looking for. He's not asking you to do this by yourselves, not to pull up your own bootstraps, but rather to allow the Holy Spirit to lift you on the wings of faith. And that in his praise and in the giving of glory, both with your lips and with your life, that one wing that would lift you to the ascent of heaven would be your faith that calls out and says, by the deeds of my faith that I will lift to the throne of heaven, and that the other wing that is there is the grace and mercy of God found in the Holy Spirit, and that that breath of that Spirit then blows upon us as we flap those wings of faith and ascend the mountain of God. Are you there with me, people? Surrender yourselves to the heart and mind of God today. Allow the desires of your heart to be placed in the hands of God Almighty, so that your desires can make people look at you and go, huh? What is this? The deeper mysteries of God can be revealed in you.